second start. And this is Dr. Diana Wiley, your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. And I now for sure know that I have my guest, Dr. Steven Snyder, on the line. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's one of the perils of being a writer and a doctor at the same time. Sometimes schedule runs away, but I'm so glad that we're finally able to get together. Thank you so much for waiting.
Oh, you're welcome. So we're going to talk about your book, Love Worth Making, How to Have Ridiculously Great Sex in a Long-Lasting Relationship. And this is such an easy, conversationally written book. I think it really could serve as a manual for couples and for therapists who are not sex experts.
Well, I'm hoping so.
Yeah, and so, Dr. Snyder, did you have an intended audience when you wrote your book?
Well, I actually had three intended audiences.
Three, okay.
Yeah, the first was people who have sexual problems and relationship problems, and they frequently go together, as you very well know.
Yes.
And the second is therapists who deal with couples, because not that many couples know much about sex therapy. And when a therapist tries to learn, often they just get lists and lists and stuff, and they just come away thinking, well, I know a lot about HIV transmission, and I know a lot about vibrators and stuff, but I don't really know anything about feelings.
And relationships and sexuality within those relationships.
Yeah, how those two fit together. And actually, the third target audience is clergy, because they get
clergy.
A lot of requests, too. Yeah, and so they often are really stuck when they can recommend something that's respectful and you know, not intended to be necessarily prurient, but that's true to life in terms of what people are encountering in terms of feelings.
Your book was unique, or is unique, in terms of your dealing with faith and religion.
Yeah, I'm
and
a religious man myself, and I felt very disappointed when I would see books. They were either extremely to the left and were against religion completely, or they were extremely to the right, and they tend to be kind of fundamentalist and not a lot of wiggle room. And so I wanted something that was really kind of reached that broad middle of people who, you know, have a religious sensibility and are, you know, at the same time kind of open-minded about people being different and diverse and just really looking to be able to have a sexual relationship that inspires them in a long-term relationship.
Yeah, I think it's very valuable, and you make so many original comments in your book. So I asked you off the air yesterday, I suggested that perhaps your book had been percolating for some years.
my whole life.
You said, yes, of course. But why did you write Love Worth Making? What were some of your main motivations?
Okay, well, the first was I couldn't find anything to give my patients that would speak to them about the kind of feelings that I thought were most crucially important in a sexual relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And so I realized that I had to write it myself, at which point my wife got this glazed look in her eyes. She went, oh, no.
She knows you, right?
She knows me.
How long have you been married?
27 years.
Oh, that's great.
She knows me well. She knew it was going to be some long nights. And, you know, she's already suffered the deprivations of being married to a doctor, and now the deprivations of being married to a writer, too. I think she was not so happy about it, but she was supportive.
But, of course, she's supportive because you probably personally know about Love Worth Making.
Well, you know, I had many, I have to be careful not to embarrass her here, but I had many, many things that I thought of for the dedication for the book. One which I thought of, which she rejected out of hand, is, but I could say it here because I didn't write it down, was, you know, to have to put up with the experience of having your husband leap out of bed and go to the word processor going, that's it, I got to write it down.
As you got inspired, right?
Exactly. And she said, no, you can't put that in the dedication.
But you have a nice dedication. Your dedication.
Figured out something else. Yeah.
It's a great book. I've never really read, and I've been doing this work for 35 years, and I know you've been doing it for 30 years. But it's a book like no other I've read. And as I was saying before you came on the air, it's really easy, conversational in its tone, and it really can serve as a manual for couples and for therapists who are not sex therapists, mm-hmm. or who are not sex experts anyway. And there are a lot of therapists who do marriage counseling, but they're not sex experts.
And as you and I both know, people often withhold information about their sexual problems if they don't think that the person they're talking to has the expertise to understand them.
That's absolutely true.
Yeah, I don't know if you had the experience when you were first developing a practice as a sex counselor, but I can remember having people in treatment with me for months or years, and at some point my mentioning, apropos of I don't know what, that you know, I actually am a sex therapist, at which point they say, oh, how come you didn't tell me? I got to tell you about this and this and this.
Exactly. Exactly.
I call it the unexpected sex therapist.
Well, I've had referrals from marriage counselors who know they don't have the expertise.
Yeah.
And then I hear stories from couples that say, oh, well, our sex problems really are at the centerpiece of our
Absolutely.
Relationship, but we talked about everything else and not our sex lives.
Often
and this went on for
years.
2 years.
Yeah, years. Yeah, it's actually a little horrifying. That
yes.
People can be years in marriage counselor and not get the nitty-gritty details of, okay, now what happens next? And who does what to whom, and how does that feel? And then what do you do next? And those are very, very simple questions, but you have to be kind of disciplined about asking them.
Yes, and what I sometimes announce is I'm not there. So a good sex therapist needs to be a little bit of a voyeur. I want to know what works and what doesn't work in some detail.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad that you mentioned that. I actually came to that with the advantage of already having been a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And as a doctor, they drill this into you so fervently. Okay, the person bled. How much blood was it? You know, how long did they bleed for? That kind of thing. And so you're used to being very intrusive about these things. So I find I'm probably a little more intrusive than my colleagues.
Yeah.
But you really have
yes.
to get the details. For instance, you know, a man touches his wife's body.
Mm-hmm.
And you say to him, okay, when you're touching your wife's body, are you touching her body for your pleasure or for hers?
Yeah, let's talk about that, because that's one of the themes in your book,
uh-huh.
and it's really important.
I'm very opinionated about this.
Uh-huh.
I'm very opinionated.
And that's good, I mean, because you're
a man.
Yeah, you're opinionated, and you're passionate about it, and it comes through in your writing.
Good. What I hear most often from men is that they're touching their wife's body for the wife's pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
And that's usually a very bad idea,
mm-hmm.
because the man now has a job to perform,
mm-hmm.
which is to give his wife pleasure. And now she's got a job to perform, which is to enjoy it. But, like, what if she's not really enjoying it? What does she do? It's much better if he touches her for his pleasure. That way she knows he's taken care of. She can experience whatever she wants to. She doesn't have to worry about him. She knows he's having a good time.
This is so difficult for so many people, though, but it's a brilliant, progressive, healthy idea, you know, to soak up the emotional experience, to feel the pleasure, the relaxation, the excitement, and the fun.
For your own
sake. And also to feel the closeness with your partner.
Yeah. People always get surprised when I say if both people are being selfish, that's more passionate.
Yeah, I know. Yes. People don't usually understand that. For years, I've talked about a concept that's aligned with what you're talking about, and it's enlightened selfishness.
Absolutely. I call it connected selfishness, but I
connected
think you're talking about the exact same, actually the same thing.
Yeah, it's the same thing. And so many, especially women, have been hardwired to please others. And so,
And what I always tell, I'm sure you tell women the same thing, that if they want to have an orgasm, is it okay I can say orgasm on this show?
You know what? This is similar to cable TV in that you can say anything you want.
Okay, great.
I mean, I've even used the word fuck on this program.
Okay, all right, so then I know I'm in good company here. Okay, so if a woman wants to have an orgasm, that she can stroke her own body to orgasm.
Mm-hmm.
And she goes, well, I would be embarrassed to do that. And I go, you know, guys love to see that. Guys get very excited.
Oh, absolutely.
That. Yeah, guys pay good money to see that in certain settings.
They do.
So to see somebody selfishly enjoying themselves is erotic. That's kind of the way we're wired. Unfortunately, most sex advice doesn't go that way. Most sex advice you read in Cosmo, you know, seven ways to rock his world in bed.
That's right.
You know, it really should be seven ways to rock your own world in bed, and he'll love that because he'll see that you're enjoying yourself, takes all the pressure off of him, and then he can rock whatever way he wants to rock.
It's so true, Dr. Snyder. It's just so very true, but that advice is often not enough out there.
Yeah.
And you, so on your website, which is loveworthmaking.com?
Loveworthmaking.com, yeah.
Yes. So there's lots of media events that you've been to and contributed for. And I really liked the Reader's Digest one with 10 obstacles.
Thank
that
you.
Can affect your, and it, the first one is putting up with bad sex, and you and I agree on this, that we have listened to a lot, because I'm a sex therapist, you're a sex therapist, we've listened to stories about bad sex a lot in our professional life,
you know,
a lot.
You know exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
The definition that I give in the book, a definition of a sex therapist is somebody who spends all day long listening to stories about bad sex.
About bad sex. So,
and as you know,
yes.
Once you've heard 1,000 stories about bad sex, you have a much better idea about how not to have bad sex. You know, all
exactly
the different ways that
right.
sex can go bad. And one of the chief ways that sex can go bad is if one person is there fervently trying to get the other person wet or hard or excited or to have a climax. That's a real recipe for bad sex.
Yeah, and your point four is, and it, sex feels like too much work, so that kind of feeds in to all of that. I had one male client, an older man actually, who considered himself kind of a jock over the years, but of course he was having erectile dysfunction at the age of 60 when he started seeing me. And he said, well, you know, with a lot of women, you just practically have to hold them up against the wall so that they'll have an orgasm. Hmm. And I said, no, that's not it. The woman needs to be responsible for her own orgasm.
Totally.
The only way she can have it is to be able to have her amygdala, her fear center, her feeling center of her brain, take a nap. She needs to let go and have the orgasm. You can't force it, but a lot of men have the idea that they can force it.
I don't know if this is consistent with your thinking, but I think it probably will. I tell guys, you know, if it's an orchestra, you're just the rhythm section.
Oh.
You're just laying down a good rhythm track. Give her something she can work on.
I like that.
Do whatever she wants with it. She can solo all she wants.
The rhythm section. Are you a musician yourself? I mean, do you play?
No, but I know what a rhythm section is. And
yeah,
it seems to
but
be
I like
a,
that.
As a man, that you're kind of the rhythm section.
Yeah.
And the woman can do whatever she wants with it.
Right.
It's up to her. And all you need to do is, you know, like any good rhythm player, just enjoy being in the rhythm.
Mm-hmm.
Enjoying being in the rhythm, and she can just know that you're happy being in the rhythm. She doesn't have to worry about you, and you're good.
And then that kind of sets her free.
It totally sets her free. You and I spoke, when we spoke off the air,
yeah,
about the woman from The Sessions, the movie, who was played by Helen Hunt, Cynthia Cohen Green.
Yes.
And how
The Sessions.
Yeah, about her first husband taught her about that, because she said he was just so deliciously selfish. He really wasn't worried about anything other than being in the moment, and it set me free. I didn't have to worry either.
You know, that's worth spending a little more time on, because I think lots of folks don't even have that concept. I think some of our listeners will remember seeing The Sessions. I think it came out in maybe 2007 or 6.
No, I think it was later. I think it was 2012 or 13.
Okay. And I told you off the air that I met her at a conference. And
oh, yeah.
She's a real woman. And I think she's still in practice. In fact, on your website are some links to some fascinating interviews you had with her at Star, right?
Well, I actually
interviewed
her over the phone.
Over the phone.
And I'd written an article on The Sessions, and she called me up, and she said, "Oh, I really like that." And I said, "Oh, great, can we talk more?" And we ended up talking a lot, and we had a good time talking about all sorts of things. And she had an autobiography called An Intimate Life.
And she talked about
her very religious upbringing and how she had to kind of get away from that, and her experiences being a hippie in California in the 60s and 70s, and how now she's in her 70s, having had a mastectomy, and she's still working as a sex surrogate. She's kind of an inspiration.
So Helen Hunt played her in the movie. So it's based on a... And for any listeners who haven't seen this movie, I would encourage you to, you could get it streamed, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And I liked it a lot. And it wasn't a very accurate depiction of sex surrogacy, because they jump into bed right together in the first scene.
That's right.
Yeah.
And usually that comes much later, if at all.
Exactly.
And sexual surrogates demand health testing and sexual health testing and so on.
Yeah.
But it still was, and for a number of years I saw a disabled man, and I, right after our first session, I said, "I really want you to see this movie, The Sessions," and he wept through it.
Yeah.
And he identified with it so much. In fact, he bought a copy of the movie.
Wow.
Because it spoke to him so deeply.
Yeah, and it was a very poignant movie, because the guy in The Sessions was so disabled. He was quadriplegic from polio as a child, that even in Berkeley, was the center of sex and disability. And even in Berkeley, where every other disabled person was having sex, he wasn't able to find a partner. So he was a very, very profoundly,
Well, he was flat on his back. He couldn't move. And he was very ambivalent about losing his virginity to this surrogate.
Yes.
But the interview you did with Green Cohen, Cheryl Green Cohen Green.
Cheryl Cohen Green, I had her name wrong, yeah.
Yeah, was wonderful. And I encourage listeners, because it's just enlightening and moving. And so read this interview that... Dr. Schneider does with her, loveworthmaking.com, the name of his book, Love Worth Making. So,
you'd mentioned that one of the things you wanted to talk about the book was this concept of a sex knot.
Yes. You have several sex knots, K-N-O-T-S, and... we've already touched on a couple of them, but where do you want to start on those? Because you've got 11 at the end of your book.
I had 11 common sex knots and how to untie them. A sex knot, a definition of a sex knot, is where your natural reaction to a situation gets you in trouble. So the more you react in the way that's natural to react, the more trouble you get into. Mm-hmm. So the classic example is a couple who are going to go to a bed and breakfast, and the guy feels under all this pressure to mm-hmm. deliver a really fine sexual experience to her, and his sexual mind doesn't like this kind of pressure. So it says, mm-hmm. well, the hell with this. I don't really feel like doing this. And so he starts having trouble with his erection. Can you hear me?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And the more trouble he has with his erection, the more agitated he gets. And as a consequence, he can't get an erection because the thing mm-hmm. that makes a man most unhappy is not being able to get an erection. And his partner thinks, oh, my goodness, he's not attracted to me. So she gets upset. And the more she gets upset, then he really gets upset, and he really can't get an erection, and the whole thing really goes to hell. So that's an example of kind of a double sex knot.
And sex right, knots double sex every, knot, right.
Sex knots are everywhere in sex therapy. And so the other classic example is a woman who lacks sexual desire, as happens in almost every relationship from time to time, frequently happens to women after a first child or even more likely after a second child. And she lacks sexual desire, so she worries about whether her husband is going to want sex. So maybe she won't wear sexy outfits in front of him because she doesn't want to turn him on for fear he'll get frustrated. And the less she dresses up, the less she has desire.
Mm-hmm.
And the less she, that means the less she dresses up and the less she has desire, and the whole thing just cycles down.
Cycles down.
And then on the male side, mm-hmm. you get a guy who is worried that his wife is upset with him. And
mm-hmm.
men hate that. Men hate when they feel women are upset with them. We really don't want to disappoint women. It's a source of a tremendous amount of problems. And so he avoids her.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what guys tend to do when they feel a woman is upset with them. They want to kind of withdraw. And women hate that because the women feel abandoned. They get even more mm-hmm. upset with the guy. And then he withdraws even further, and he stops initiating sex. And she's sure it means that he doesn't desire her anymore. And so she gets more upset, and he withdraws even further, and the whole thing just goes to hell. So sex knots are really in almost every couple who presents for treatment of a sexual problem. And sometimes if you can identify exactly what the steps are for tying this thing, then that'll lead you to figure out how to untie it. And so I have an appendix in the back of my book, which is the 11, which I think are probably the most common sex knots
right.
I see, with explicit directions on how to untie them. First you do this, then you do that.
Yeah, your book is very, very practical, and it's based also on lots of many hours of seeing your patients. And then what I like about your book, one of many things, is that you describe your cases, and you do the disclaimer at the beginning of your book, which of course is important to do, that it's a composite of your patients. It's not, and you change the names and all of that. But you, you know, you really bring to life these people in your book.
Thank you. I worked very hard at that because, among my other hats, I'm the chairman of the Consumer Book Award Committee for the Society of Sex Therapy and Research.
Mm-hmm.
And in that capacity, I've read many, 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 many sex books, as I'm sure you have too.
Mm-hmm.
And when they have people in them, the people tend not to come across as real people.
Mm-hmm.
There are a couple of paragraphs of description, but you don't really get a feel. You don't really remember who these people were. And I really passionately wanted to have the people be people that people could actually remember. So, one, there's not that many of them. There's just a few characters. And
yes.
I took the time to kind of get into the characters. And there's much more dialogue than is typical in a book like this, because that's how people read and that's how people talk. And nobody wants to read just page and page of description. Usually people want to hear how people talk. So in my book, there are people actually talking to each other.
Well, and not only that, but people reading this respond to reading about other people's struggles.
Yeah.
If they can identify, they can learn. Stories are so important.
Yeah, I think it's all stories. You know, it's the oldest part of our brain. We like stories. And as a doctor, it's one of the only things that I can remember is the stories of the people that I've seen and the lessons I've learned from them. You know, the actual facts and figures and statistics go in one ear and went out the other. So I'm one of the rare books on sex that doesn't have facts and statistics in it. There's really no numbers in the whole book.
I noticed that. Yes, no numbers.
Yeah. Yeah.
That does make your book original and quite wonderful.
Thank you. You know Carol Gilligan's book In a Different Voice?
I don't think I do. I wish I did.
Carol Gilligan wrote a book many, many years ago about female psychology. It was one of the first books. When was it? I have to search my memory. I think it was in the 1980s. It was one of the first books that talked about how female social psychology was really different from male social psychology, and she was really criticized for not having any numbers in the book. It was a research book, but she was criticized for not having any statistics, and I thought to myself, you know, there was a reason for that. She just didn't want to distract anybody with a lot of numbers. Instead, it was just accounts and stories, and I thought it was very, very beautiful, and I always thought that was a good way to do it.
Yeah, a very good way to do it. So kind of tied in with what you're talking about, and I think we should elaborate on it a little more, is
okay.
So the Reader's Digest 10 obstacles, and of course it's also in your Sex Knots, is not being selfish enough, and we've talked a little bit about that, but I think we should talk more because, I talk about enlightened selfishness. You talk about connected selfishness.
Yes, selfishness is absolutely key.
And because a lot of people don't really get that concept very easily.
Right, right. One of the things that I did in the book is I relate it to kind of a theory of sexuality. Would it be okay if I could talk some about the theory?
I think you should, definitely.
Okay, the theory of sexuality is that what makes sexual experience special is that it reawakens feelings from earliest childhood.
Yes.
Feelings of being rocked and held and fussed over and treated like the most important person in the world. Because we're the only animal that gets that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have this, what's called the fourth trimester, because the human brain emerges, you know, through the birth canal so immature and so small, and it needs another year to grow to where it can walk on its own. You know, most animals, they walk within a week or so of being born. But humans, they take a year before they can do that.
Yes,
so we have this fourth trimester during which we're completely helpless. And I don't think it's any accident that feelings of surrender, feelings of delicious helplessness, feelings of letting go, feelings of being completely carried away in an experience where you're the most important person in the world and where you're treated as just very, very special, those really ring very powerfully for us. And I don't think it's any accident that all love songs have the word baby in them.
Yes. That's so true.
Be my baby. I mean, where does that come from? Be my baby. You know, it probably
be
is.
Be my baby.
That,
or, hey, babe.
Hey, babe. Yeah, baby, baby, baby. Oh, you're mine, baby, baby. Or, you know, mine. Who talks like that? Two-year-olds. You know, we're a very possessive species. We want to know
That's
mine.
That's right. Possessive species. Yeah. And yeah. I think that this also, by the way, gives great value. I believe in it. I breastfed each of my children for a year. I think breastfeeding is really important, for that bonding. And that's when that baby feels a oneness with mommy.
Totally. And I think that it later gets registered in adult lovemaking as that primordial sense of oneness.
Mm-hmm.
The original act of penetration is the nipple penetrating the baby's mouth.
Yes, isn't that true?
Yeah.
Now that, you can say that as a psychiatrist better than, you know, just your average psychologist, because there's some Freudian stuff in all of that, which I totally think is accurate.
He was a pretty clever man. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the Freud, the original idea that adult sexuality has some relationship to infantile experience was Freud's. You know, he wrote the three essays on the theory of sexuality in 1905.
1905, yeah.
Described that, and his science was a little different than ours, but the original insight is really there.
Mm-hmm.
The other implication, I think, of the original act of penetration being the nipple in the baby's mouth,
mm-hmm.
is I think it helps explain some of the fact that men freak out around intercourse.
And yeah, do talk more about that. I think that's fascinating, Dr.
It's very
Snyder.
Rare. It's very rare in a sex book to hear anything about male sexuality. Female sexuality gets explored all the time.
Mm-hmm.
There are hundreds of books about female sexuality, but anything coherent about male sexuality
mm-hmm.
is very hard to find. It's almost the dark continent, just a little bit like female sexuality was the dark continent 50 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so all forms of male sexual difficulty that are due to psychological reasons all get worse in the presence of a willing vagina. And it's really remarkable. A guy,
that's definitely Freudian.
Guy
can he also talk about
there.
Male fears of the vagina, like unconsciously having a mouth?
Well, it is in a way, it is a mouth.
Uh-huh, yeah.
Just like the other mouth, it is an opening that leads somewhere mysterious.
Mm-hmm.
It has a similar feel and consistency to a human mouth.
Yes.
It has lips. And to a man, when a woman opens herself to intercourse, he has the feeling that she's hungry.
Mm-hmm.
That she's hungry for him.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's a switch up, because most lovemaking up to that usually dramatizes his hunger for her. He wants her body. He wants to have her clothes off. He wants to feel and experience her body. Once she opens her vagina to him, things shift. Now she's hungry for him. Now he is going to, in a deep way, feed her. That's if things go well. Most men get very queasy at that point, because women almost seem to be wired, for the most part, to be comfortable with being nourishing individuals, to nourish a baby, to nourish a partner, to nourish a friend, comfortable with nourishment. Men don't seem to be so comfortable with their own adequacy as someone who can nourish someone. And a man frequently has, unconsciously, the worry that his capacities aren't going to be sufficient. He's not going to have enough to nourish her. She's going to be still hungry. She'll want more than he really has to give. And so on a deep level, it makes him profoundly anxious. Is that making sense?
Absolutely, but I'm thinking that on the upside of this, a man who is confident as a man and as a lover has that capacity to contain his lovers, his partners, his wife's robust libido
yes.
and
yes.
sexuality and expression and maybe multiple orgasms.
Absolutely, and feels comfortable with being the nourisher.
The nourisher.
Yeah, but a lot of guys aren't comfortable with that.
Well, and a lot of guys aren't comfortable with it, and maybe they need to do some work, because I think it's all very much tied in. Sexual confidence is often tied in with self-confidence.
Absolutely, but, you know, I don't think I'm quite as hopeful about it as you are.
Okay, so say more about that.
Yeah.
That's fascinating, yes.
Now, here's why. Because
mm-hmm.
the raw facts are that a woman's capacity for sexual enjoyment is often far greater than a man's.
Mm-hmm.
He gets one erection, or maybe two if he's very young and very horny,
mm-hmm.
one ejaculation, maybe two if he's very young and very horny, and then he's done.
Mm-hmm.
He has a finite capacity. Her arousal is a renewable resource.
Mm-hmm.
If she doesn't, unless she gets sore, she could literally go all night. Guys are keenly aware of that. they're keenly aware that they have finite resources and she has potentially infinite resources.
Mm-hmm.
So even if they're very, very fully psychologically realized and confident men, still there's a twinge of anxiety that maybe mm-hmm. they want more. Maybe this woman wants more than I can really supply her with.
Mm-hmm.
And men fantasize and imagine that the woman's needs are endless. And you see this in male fears that the woman is, you know, like a quote, nymphomaniac or something. She's going to deplete me, take everything I have, and still not be satisfied. And men really, really do worry about that on a profound level. So I think your confident man is a guy who's managed to contain that worry and is able to handle it. But I don't think any man is entirely free of that worry.
That may well be true. I'm probably a little spoiled because I'm now married to one of those confident men. It's just delightful.
Even the most confident man, I think that worry is there somewhere in the back of his
mind. Mm-hmm. Maybe so.
So every form of male sexual dysfunction that is psychologically induced is worse in the presence of a willing vagina. A guy
yes.
can
oh, hard
that everything.
That until, I've encountered, of course,
yeah, until
in my,
she opens
in
her
my
leg, and then
sex therapy practice.
Out. Yeah. A guy who is in danger of coming too fast, which is most
mm-hmm.
Can manage not to have an orgasm with everything, but the penis goes in the vagina, he's going to come right away. The other extreme, a guy can manage to have an orgasm with his partner, maybe with oral sex, but put the penis in the vagina, he can't ejaculate at all. There's something about the vagina that really does spook guys. I once gave a lecture about this to a group of young people, and one woman in the front who looked like she was about 13 months pregnant. I was talking about how men are frightened of the vagina, and she said, "They should be."
Look what happens.
Look what happens. And, you know, I think no matter how much we understand the science and the biology of reproduction, still there's something mystical about that.
There's something astonishing
about it.
And you know what? That can be part of the mystery, the sacredness, the ecstasy.
Without question.
That when you're having ecstatic sex and there's this merging, there's still a little mystery about it, and that's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, but people vary in how much astonishment they're able to bear.
I know. And it goes a lot, and you talk about this in your book, back to the childhood.
Yes.
And if there was deprivation, if there was withholding on the part of the mother.
Or just simple misattunement, mother
mm-hmm.
and child that weren't very well suited to each other by temperament.
Yeah. Oh, yes. And there's that, too. There's that, too. Oh, you know, I'm so glad we still have time, but I want to tell our listening audience that you will return May the 1st, and you're going to, for the first caller, my regular listeners know this, the first caller will receive a copy of your book, which is Love Worth Making. It's a fabulous book. So that'll be May the 1st.
And so, I'm delighted that you're willing to have that that giveaway. So that's great.
Well, I'm delighted that you're willing to do it because
okay, great.
My experience has been when I announce a free book, people that are listening often will call in. They want the free book, but then they're willing. But you know, they're willing to ask a question. And of course, radio is one reason I love doing radio. 8 years
uh-huh.
now on Progressive Radio Network.
Uh-huh.
5 years before that in Hawaii. Radio is rather intimate.
Yes,
in that. That, you know, you can't see the person, but you can feel it. And then if people call in, they feel like they have a certain amount of privacy, unless somebody recognizes their voices.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
Yeah, so let's go to another obstacle.
Okay.
And that's a saving intimacy for the bedroom. You know, we sex therapists talk about simmering, and you make some very good points in your book about moments that you can feel excited together. Mm-hmm. Could you expand on that? Because
yeah, do your listeners know the definition of the word simmering as we use it?
No, I don't think they do necessarily.
Let's expand on that too. It's allowing yourself to get excited with your mm-hmm. partner under circumstances where you're probably not going to be having sex.
Mm-hmm.
So hence the analogy to simmering. You're going to turn up the heat and let the water get a little hot, but you're not bringing it to a boil. You're not going to cook anything. You're just simmering.
Good description.
The classic example of simmering is what most people remember from when they were teenagers. You have 5 minutes between classes. You meet at one of your lockers. You're like boyfriend and girlfriend. You hold each other, feel each other's bodies, mold to mm-hmm. each other's bodies, inhale the scent of each other's hair, breathe
mm-hmm.
together, move together a little bit, and then the bell rings. Take a deep breath, stare deeply into each other's eyes, kiss each other, and run off in opposite directions, both feeling just a little buzzed and a little bit have a hard time paying attention to the first 10 minutes of the next class because mm-hmm. you're aroused.
Mm-hmm.
That's the simmer. And for most couples, at least in Manhattan, I'm interested in Seattle whether it's the same thing, most couples these days in the 21st century are working very, very long hours because they've got email and everything.
Oh, yes.
And they don't. Yeah. Most couples in Manhattan don't have sex except on weekends.
Mm-hmm.
And so I always tell couples that, you know, that's really nice, but it's not enough to keep an erotic connection. The erotic climate, one might say, in your relationship is going to cool down if you wait from just weekend to next weekend.
Mm-hmm.
You want to be simmering, if you can, every day. And simmering is a great alternative to cuddling. You know, if you're just sitting on the couch watching TV, I mean, you know, you might want to exchange a little sexual energy while you're doing that. All you have to do is realize that every time you get excited, you don't have to have sex. You could just enjoy being excited, as we say, like in Verizon, like Fios, fiber optic system. It's FIOS for its own sake. So you're just simmering Fios for its own sake just because it's nice to be excited. A lot of people, couples, they regard feeling excited as like some kind of an irritant that they have to get rid of by having sex and having an orgasm. You don't have to get rid of it. You can just, you know, kind of conserve it. And instead of kissing your husband or wife goodnight, you just simmer them goodnight. You know, just a minute or two, and then you could go to bed excited. That's really nice.
And that's good simmering, and because so many women really need to feel that they're, and men too, but women need to feel that their partner is interested, desirous, and just the simmering and the touching mm-hmm. can help that woman feel that.
Oh, it makes her feel irresistible.
And really desire.
Every woman I've ever met wants to feel.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
And the other thing is when you kiss each other goodbye in the morning before you go off to work, don't just kiss each other goodbye. You could simmer each other goodbye.
Mm-hmm.
And you end up walking out the door feeling just a little frustrated. That's good. It's like when you're a teenager and the bell rings for the next class, you feel just a little frustrated. That's good. It keeps you in the game.
I'm remembering when I was a teenager.
It was a very long time ago.
But
making out in the car was like a religious experience. I'm sure you can remember it as clear as day. As clear as day.
Yeah. And I have memories of that. And they're just lovely memories.
Wonderful memories, yeah.
Yeah.
And sometimes there may have been an orgasm, and many times there wasn't. And
mm-hmm.
if there wasn't, that's fine. You don't have to go through the whole Masters and Johnson sex response cycle every time you get excited together. Sometimes you just want to kind of stay in the game.
Yeah, I think that when we talk again on May the 1st, we should talk a little bit about that, about
What specifically?
Not having to have an orgasm every time.
Right. Right. And maybe we'll
paying attention to your own arousal. We've touched on that in this, but your book is very good about that. For the man, because this will lower his difficulties. Mm-hmm. You know, if a man feels he has to give her an orgasm,
right.
And if instead he's paying attention to his own arousal, the sex is going to be much better.
Much better, much better, because there's going to be some passion in it.
Mm-hmm.
Passion is selfish. As I always say, you know, no hero in a romance novel ever rips a woman's clothes off and says, okay, now tell me how you like to be touched.
I read that, and I think that's that's brilliant.
True.
It's so
true.
So true.
And yet,
I've known a lot of low desire women who've tried to raise their arousal by reading romance novels.
Uh huh.
And sometimes it works, and sometimes it doesn't. But
yeah, it depends a lot on the woman. But I think one of the nice things about a romance novel for most women who like them,
mm-hmm.
is there's a man in the book who really only has one thing on his mind,
mm-hmm.
which is that woman. You
mm-hmm.
know, the classic example is Christian Grey. I mean, he's doing a billion-dollar deal, and all
yeah.
he's thinking about is, I can't wait to get back to Anna Steele because her body just is so exquisite. And
right.
for most women, there's a great scene in 50 Shades of Grey, which I'm one of the few guys who's read all three books because, you know, it's for professional purposes. I even got a
I know. I read all three, too, but you're right. Not a lot of guys do read all three.
I actually wrote an article once called 50 Shades for Men, things
uh-huh.
that could learn. And one of the things to say is, you know, Christian Grey is very organized. You know, he goes into his red room of pain. He knows exactly what he wants to do, and he can find everything. And, you know, he's never having to ask Anna, you know, where's his mid-size anal beads. You know, he knows where everything is. She can just kind of relax.
You're great, Dr. Snyder. You know, I think your wife is a lucky woman. You tell her I said so, too.
Thank you. I will.
You know, your openness and the way you write is so quite. It is so open
and it's
very readable. I mean, there are some experts who write rather academic books that most people can't access very well.
Yeah. Not even academics can read them usually.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Yeah, I mean, as my friend Paul Joannidis, do you know Paul? He's
yes, I've had him on the show. It's been a while, but his book is just, I think it's in its...
Beautiful book.
A tenth edition or something.
Yeah, yeah. And
Getting It On.
Guide to Getting It On.
Guide to Getting It On,
I
yes.
I consider my book a little bit of a kind of a supplement to his book, because his has to do with all the physical aspects. And
yeah.
Mine has to do with all the kind of emotional and spiritual aspects. And he says the problem with most sex books is they don't get anybody hard and they don't get anybody wet. and so I say in my book, you know, it's not intended to get you hard or wet, but it's not intended to get in your way either.
Well, exactly. Now, the program is about to stop because they stop us a few minutes before the hour, but I wanted to quote Christiane Northrup, who is in your book, and I really like this. This is advanced praise. She says, it's the most practical, fun, and empowering book I've ever read on how to have fabulous sex, how to have a fabulous sex life in a committed relationship. And, you know, that's exactly right. It's practical, it's fun, it's empowering. And I encourage our listeners, and they can get your book probably Amazon or
anywhere,
at your website.
Anywhere books are sold, Amazon,
yeah.
Barnes & Noble, any independent bookstore. Or if they want the link to buy it, they just go on my website. It's loveworthmaking.com.
Right. And by the way, I was in Barnes & Noble. I still love the bookstores. I like to go there.
Uh-huh.
And I went there, and you'd already sent me your book, but there were several copies of your book. I was so happy, and I told the guy who was the general manager, I said, this book is really worthwhile. You must encourage your buyers to get it.
Thank you so much. You know, it's like I, you know, did kind of put my soul in, and I'm hoping that it turns out to be useful to people. So, you know, that'll be a good reward if that turns out to be the case.
Well, it will be useful to people.
Thank you for having me to give away.
And I'm delighted you're coming back. So May 1st.
I'm hearing the music. That must mean that we're reaching the end.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Snyder.
All right. All right, Diana. Good to talk to you. We'll talk to you.
Bye-bye, everybody.
All right.
Bye-bye. Nel labirinto di un amaro autore.
Mai tuoi piedi, ta 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 ta. Mai tuoi piedi, ta ta ta.